Hey, y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, today on the show, we're going to talk about some things. And some stuff. Should be good, I guess. I don't know. You know what? That's not right. That should say something else here. Yeah, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. The Scott Horton Show. I'm on Liberty Radio Network and Anomaly Radio. And then the reruns also are playing on APS Radio News and I don't know where all. Anyway, so that's the deal. The show is libertarian foreign policy mostly. Although, you know, sometimes I talk about other stuff. But not so much. Well, cops and central banking. But not really too much of that. Mostly my thing is the wars, because that's the most important thing. That's the very worst thing. In fact, I think that might be the very worst thing on the planet. America's foreign policy. That's no good. So, it's strange. Sometimes people, they just post their entire articles in my comment section, and don't they know that it's not going to post? I don't get it. Anyway. Sorry. I'm still taking care of stuff that I should have taken care of before the show, during the start of the show here. And I just farted. You probably heard that. How good is this microphone anyway? Jeez. It's my show. It's the best show in the world, according to the very few people who like it. It's a narrow kind of a niche, I think. Those who like me and are interested in the same things as me. But anyway, for those of you who are that, welcome. Sorry that I've let you down so bad so far, but I'm working on some substance here. I'll have to answer that. So here's the deal. Looks like so far the interviews are all going to be in the last hour of the show. Reza Meraji is going to be here on the show to talk about the nuclear deal. And one of the things I like about talking with Reza Meraji is that he's not objective. He really wants a nuclear deal with Iran, and I do too. And I think for the same reason that it's the last big outstanding fake issue that really prevents a rapprochement between our government and the government of Iran. And so let's just be done with it then. And since it's a big fake crisis in the first place, it ought to be very simple to resolve. You guys stay safeguarded. And we'll start lifting some sanctions and see if we can start getting along. Huh? That sounds reasonable enough to me. That sounds reasonable enough to Reza Meraji. And so I'm going to ask him all about that, the progress that's been made so far under the interim deal, the hurdles that still must be overcome, how he continues to stay so optimistic and positive about the whole thing in the face of so many poison pills and so much entrenched opposition.
Ever since the interim deal last fall, The Iran nuclear issue has sort of fallen out of the headlines. I mean, it's still being discussed in some places, particularly by the war party that'll never be satisfied. The worst of the Republicans in Congress, that kind of thing. But the truth is that this is still so important. Again, it is a fake outstanding issue, but it is outstanding. And it is the excuse invoked against any kind of new strategy, new possible peaceful take on relations with Iran. And that's what it's for in the first place. And so, anyway, you know, I don't know. I guess giving it attention on this show doesn't really make a difference, but at least you guys will be up to date on what the hell's going on, if you're interested. I sure as hell am. And speaking of which, and this will probably come up in the interview, but I want to go ahead and mention it now because not everybody can listen to all 3 hours and this and that. But I want you to know, and you can go back and find it in the weekend editions of antiwar.com. If you just look in the left margin at antiwar.com, you can go back in time for a week there. See a little Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So go there, and if you look at the weekend edition, you'll see, wasn't it the weekend, or maybe it was Friday? Anyway, god dang it, it's Gareth Porter interviewed in Haaretz, and it's so good. Here it is. It's called, "Was the Iranian Threat Fabricated by Israel and the U.S.? In a new book and in a conversation with Haaretz, U.S. historian Gareth Porter charges that U.S. and Israeli policies on Iran have been based on fabricated evidence." And this is such a great retelling. It's a little bit of a review, and then it kicks over into an interview of all the follow-up questions and all of the right follow-up questions for the heroic Gareth Porter. And he nails them. And it's beautiful. And to see this in Haaretz is just so exciting to me that, wow, look, here you go. Honesty. Finally. A frank discussion of the Iran nuclear issue in the Israeli media. And, you know, Haaretz, they've run stories about how Mossad has been honest about this for quite a few years now and stuff like that. So it's not that the truth is completely absent from this paper or anything. But not like this. Here's Gareth Porter with Manufactured Crisis says, "Oh, no, see, the thing is, there never was a nuclear program. The Americans and the Israelis have, for various reasons at different times, liked to pretend that there was an Iranian nuclear weapons program." That's what I meant to say, weapons program. For their various reasons, whether Palestine issues or whether, you know, because the CIA needed a reason to exist or whatever it was. And so there you go. Anyway, it's just great. Gareth Porter's Triumph, Manufactured Crisis, reviewed in Haaretz. Was the Iranian threat fabricated by Israel and the U.S.? Reads the headline, and the answer, of course, is yes. In fact, you know, I had a guy email me, said, oh, great, Gareth Porter, there we go. I need to get with the nicknames. Says, everybody is the great this. How about, what do we got here? We got the magnificent Margolis, the great Gareth Porter, excellent Ray McGovern, or the X-Ray, Ray McGovern, fantastic Phil Giraldi. Yeah, I think we're still working on the Patrick Coburn one there. Meticulous Marcy Wheeler, yeah, you got that right. See, this is what I need, is like a sidekick on the show. Somebody who's intelligent and funny and creative. You know, the supplement my complete and total lack of creativity and humor. yeah. Anyway. Gareth Porter and Manufactured Crisis reviewed in Haaretz. Glory day! All right. Reza Marashi coming up on the Iran nuclear deal. And then Phil Giraldi on to talk about the CADA. And he just emailed me and asked, well, what about the CADA? But, well, you know me, man. Basically, this is the deal. I interviewed, oh, the music's going to start playing in a sec. I interviewed Michael Scheuer last Friday, and boy, did he have some hawkish things to say about Al-Qaeda in the world. A lot of which made a lot of sense to me. But Phil Giraldi is the much more calm and reasonable Michael Scheuer, really, at the end of the day, isn't he? So let's see, you know, because Scheuer's, he's for torture. He's got some discrepancies. Giraldi's, well, they're, yeah, anyway. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, so... Boy, I better put Ukraine back on my list down here. So much going on. Looks like there's been an attack by the Ukrainian military against some targets in the east with some civilian casualties. It's still kind of breaking, not confirmed sort of information as far as I know right now, but looks pretty bad. Who other than the right sector Nazis want to see a civil war in Ukraine? Oh, let's get the cooler heads prevailing. And you know, back the other day when they had the big fight over the airport, it was still sort of an open question, wasn't it, about whether it was the old regime or the new that had sent the military to go and fight. But I guess it's still possible, but much more doubtful that this would have been some kind of rogue operation out from under the authority of the Chocolate King. But I don't really know. Things there could get, pretty badly out of control. There still could be a nuclear war between America and Russia over Ukraine at this point. You understand that. It's not that I'm, like, trying to scare the crap out of you with a bunch of alarmist nonsense or whatever, because I think the chances are low, but they're, I don't know, 1,000% higher than they were back in, say, I don't know, last July. Last June. A year ago. Why in the world, how in the world did the American regime change machine think that they could get away with this? That Vladimir Putin was just going to sit still and take it while they used Nazis to overthrow the government in Kiev. They thought he wouldn't seize Crimea. They thought he wouldn't encourage people in the east to go ahead and defy the new Nazi coup d'etat junta that the world empire based out of North America had installed there. Oh, yeah. You know, if there's one thing about Vladimir Putin I know, it's that he loves to just bend right over and take it. Yeah. In fact, everybody, when they see him, they point and laugh and make fun of him for what a tiny little sissy he is. And how everybody just gets away with smacking him in the face with the back of their hands, and he never does anything about it. Right? Isn't that Vladimir Putin's reputation? Or not so much. I'm thinking not so much. Anyway. So now what they've done is they've helped to create a civil war situation. Maybe the Chocolate King could have won the election in December if they'd just gone with the deal for the early elections in December. And to be, I don't know, man. It's kind of mixed messages here. I'd ask some guy from Moon of Alabama or whatever what they think of this, but seemed to me like the Americans, maybe this was just cover, the Americans and the Europeans trying to cut that deal to keep Yanukovych in power till December. And maybe it was just the Nazis said, nope, not good enough for us. Part of the deal was you have to pull your police back. So he did. So the Nazis said, that's it. Let's go ransack all the buildings. Let's take them and let's seize them. And put up iron crosses and 88s and white power flags and Confederate flags. And that's what they did. And that was really what did the coup. But not only that, though, here's my contradictory cognitive dissonance type of information there. And that is the Der Spiegel article we talked about where the billionaires were told by the Europeans and the Americans, we're going to steal all of your money if you do not sacrifice this guy right now. And so the Party of Regions, that was his political party, Yanukovych, the president at the time, the Party of Regions said, okay, you're out.
because they were going to get their personal assets seized by the U.S. Treasury, or, you know, any assets that were outside of the country. And so that was what really did the coup, that and the Nazis seizing the buildings. So it may have been that, well, it may have been an incoherent policy, and it may have been that the deal to keep him in power till December was simply a ruse, while they were really going ahead and putting the screws to the oligarchs and making them overthrow him. But anyway, it was a Western-backed coup d'etat in cooperation with the Nazis. I mean, real Hitler-loving Nazis. And, you know, here's the thing about this, man. And I keep trying to get Brendan O'Neill on the air, but I believe he's ill or something. But they just had this whole thing across Europe where right-wing nationalist parties won. And there are various degrees of right-wing nationalist. And some of them, as UKIP seems to be pretty more like just kind of sort of fiscal conservative corporatist types, but anti-EU. And then you have the National Front in France, where those guys are a bunch of Nazis. I don't know if they love Hitler, but they sure are fascists. And you've got, you know, Geert Wilders, his group lost in Denmark. But you had Golden Dawn. Those guys are Nazis down in Greece. They picked up a couple of seats. But then you had some different parties from around in Eastern and Western Europe, both, where, you know, they're sort of right-wing populist parties, but they're really not Nazis. They're really not ethnic chauvinists or, you know, really that reactionary. They just don't like the EU. And, of course, if you're a, you know, pro-EU, one-world commie type, then you want to smear all of those guys as all a bunch of Nazis when it really just isn't so. On the other hand, you want to talk about this Svoboda Party and Right Sector in Ukraine, both of whom did pretty poorly in the elections. That's how well they represent the actual people of Ukraine. But those parties have seats in the government because they helped do the coup d'etat. The leader of the Right Sector neo-Nazi militia is the head of the National Guard. In fact, the Right Sector militia is the National Guard at this point. I don't think they had a National Guard before. It's a whole new force. It's like the SA, the party militia, come to be part of the government. Oh, sorry for the Nazi comparison, except that these guys walk around with 88s, and that stands for Heil Hitler. Because 8 is represents H, the 8th letter of the alphabet. So that's their little code word there. And it's not much of a code, since they put it up there on a big iron cross and on their Volkswagen, or however you say it. Sorry, I don't speak Nazi very well, but it's the Ukrainian Nazi version of the swastika. It's sort of looks like a kind of a heavy metal capital N, but with a line through the center of it, straight, a vertical line straight down through the center of it. And that was the official slogan of the Ukrainian SS under Goering in World War II, where they participated in the Holocaust against Poles and Jews, civilians. And these guys are the heroes of the Svoboda Party and the Right Sector America's put in power in Ukraine, in Kiev. And then they act like any resistance to their rule in the East is all just because those Easterners are the sock puppets of Vladimir Putin. Talk about lying your ass off. Talk about turning the truth on its head. America and the Nazis. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And you know, it's funny, I don't know how funny it is. I hate being redundant on the show and just saying the same stupid stuff over and over again. I hate sounding like I assume that you don't know the kind of basic truth of what's going on around here and all that kind of thing. And when I read people saying, hey, listen, everybody, you know, the narrative on TV is not quite right. Actually, there's more to it than that. I sort of think, yeah, come on, everybody knows that, right? But then I remember that, no, everybody doesn't know that. And that's why whoever it was decided, man, I better write this article and try to add to the snapping out of it by the more people. It's amazing to me that anyone thinks that whatever the TV narrative is probably right, given the benefit of the doubt. Well, TV says that Putin is trying to recreate the Soviet Union by reconquering all of Eastern Europe, and he's starting with Ukraine. I guess that probably must be right then, if that's what TV's saying, and I don't know anything more about it. The last thing I'm going to do is default to, well, you know, I don't know enough about it to determine whether the TV is lying or not, but I'm going to assume they're lying because they're liars. And at best, they're effing stupid. And the best they know how to do is repeat what the government told them is true in the first place, which is stupid. So how about not giving them the benefit of the doubt? How about when they tell you, yeah, the reason that we have to do the thing that we're doing is because of the unmitigated, unprovoked evil of the other side, you just assume they're lying. You just assume that I get it. You guys must have done a coup d'etat where you installed real, legit, Hitler-loving Nazis in power in Kiev. And that's what the people in eastern Ukraine are mad about, right? Is that these guys swear to God that they love Hitler. The people that you put in power there, USA and CNN. I'm talking to you, Christian Amanpour. Anyway. Wouldn't it be nice if that was the default? You guys must be lying because you all agree. Putin's on the defensive here. It's the Americans who are the Nazis, see? It's the Americans who are the National Socialists, hell-bent on conquering the planet Earth. Hell-bent on it not only encircling Germany forever, but encircling Russia, and in fact dismantling it into its smallest pieces. No, this isn't a replay from 30 years ago, and I meant to say USSR when I said Russia. No, they want to dismantle Russia. They want regime change in Russia. They want no power on earth that can be independent from the United States of America's government and its dictates. That's the problem with Russia, see? The same one with China. They have enough power to be independent. And that is not okay. That is why we must pivot to Asia. That's why we have to pivot to Africa, because that's all about keeping resources out of the hands of the Chinese. It's the same damn pivot. And also, it's good for wasting money on army generals and stuff who like that. But it's the Americans who are the Nazis. It's the Americans who have murdered a Holocaust worth of people since the end of World War II. The Soviets murdered a Holocaust worth of people before that, don't get me wrong. And in fact, you look at decreased standards of living under communism in the Soviet Union, you could probably, you know, yeah. But, okay. But since 1989, since 1990, it's the Americans who are the butchers of the planet Earth. And I'm from here too, just like you, but that doesn't make it not right just because you're from here. What if the Swedes got all crazy and invaded Denmark? But your auntie was from Sweden. Would that make it not true? That would make it Denmark's damn fault just because your auntie's from there? Or the facts are the facts. The Americans killed somewhere between 3 and 5 million Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Laotians. But no one was counting. Not really. So many people died that a lot of them weren't countable because everyone who ever knew that they existed all died too. Every record of their life having ever existed had been destroyed, napalmed, right out of space and time. Murdered approximately a couple of million Iraqis since Jimmy Carter gave Saddam the green light and some money to invade Iran back in 1980. Anyway, as Bill Hicks would have put it, skip into the chase. You all in your hearts know the truth and know the arguments. They're lying to you. this simple narrative that Vladimir Putin wants to take over Eastern Europe. Even if that was true, fine. Who's giving him the excuse? You know, Barack Obama might as well be a Russian agent doing false flag attacks and giving him the excuse to go in and intervene and take back Crimea or whatever crap. You know, if you look at it from the Russian point of view, the Americans are his perfect foil. They're the best thing that ever happened to his political career. He's got the highest approval rating ever right now. And anyway, it's just not true. It's the Americans. Go pull out a globe. Go pull out an atlas. Go pull up an image on Google. It's the Americans that are doing everything they can to bring in the entire former Warsaw Pact and the former Soviet republics into NATO. I mean, they haven't gotten to Belarus yet. But they're working on it. They had an attempted regime change in Belarus just a couple of years ago. And anyway, I guess, you know, I don't know. I know it doesn't make a damn bit of difference, not really, but I feel like, you know, people at least need some place to go where they can find out that somebody is disputing the narrative. Actually, what all you heard about how, you know, boo-hoo for poor little Ukraine, did you hear that the Russians are after him, is a bunch of crap. And the real truth is, it's the Americans and their European satellites that are after the Ukrainians, stealing their country away and plunging them into a civil war that's only, I'm afraid, just beginning. I guess, you know, baby Jesus could come down and hold some negotiations and work everything out or something, but I just don't see it happening. You know, the new dictator there, the new so-called president, the chocolate king that they've now installed in power, he originally said that he wanted to have some talks, and then apparently the Americans corrected him. No, you don't want to have some talks. You know, talks that would include all the parties involved to try to create a peace. Damn Democrats. It's a damn shame over there. But anyway, if you want to know the truth of it, in fact, here's a really good article. They published it at the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. And it was called Meet the Americans Behind the Coup in Kiev. Something like that. Meet the Americans, Coup, Kiev. Yeah, that, you'll find it if you search that. It's at the Ron Paul Institute. And a very in-depth look at all the NGOs and all the groups that the Americans have been bankrolling all on. Oh no, the Americans, they were just bankrolling democracy in Ukraine. They never cared who won, right? Just because Archer Daniels Midland cared who won, that doesn't mean the American government cared who won. Just because the Navy cared who won, that doesn't mean the American government cared who won. Just because John McCain and Victoria Nuland were on the Maiden giving away sandwiches and cookies and money and supporting the putsch against Yanukovych. Oh no, all they wanted was self-rule for the good people of Ukraine. And so guarantee that by overthrowing a democratically elected government and installing it with a coup d'etat putsch regime. And then, of course, an election that is at least de facto rigged because the East has already declared their autonomy. And if they were permitted to participate in the elections, many of them chose not to. And then, of course, there were already cases of their ballot, their boxes being stuffed and their ballots being thrown out and the rest. As opposed to the election of 2010 that put the Eastern guy in power in the first place, which all the international observers agreed was legit. Not that democracy is the end of everything, but it's more legitimate than a military, Nazi-backed, foreign government-backed coup. Oh man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com.
They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the dang thing here. So I started reading Greenwald's book. I like reading Greenwald, man. He's good. So it shouldn't take too long. I don't have too much time to read, but I'm into it now. You got me hooked. I already learned a couple things. It's good. I like it. So, anyway, there's that. Did you see the new piece in the New York Times by James Risen and Laura Poitras? She, again, is the documentary filmmaker who got the leak with Greenwald here. They are the only two who have all the documents. And it's James Risen. He is their top intelligence beat reporter at the NSA. More about him in a moment. NSA collecting millions of faces from web images. And what's notable in here is that it still doesn't work very well. Match up innocent people with so-called guilty people or allegedly guilty people all the time. That kind of thing. But also, there's apparently no limit on the number of faces that they're trying to collect. They declined to say whether this really included everybody. And I admit, I should have reread this thing another time. Because I'm getting conflicting ideas here. I believe that they said, no, I mean, they still need a warrant to do this to Americans. But then later they say, well, the NSA declined to answer whether they're doing this to Americans or not. But anyway, it just goes to show it's just one more angle, and anyone could have guessed. It's not like this is completely surprising, but it really does add to that total information awareness that they want to have on everybody. And it makes sense that they would be, the theory of the NSA that they're actually just trying to keep Al-Qaeda from blowing you up, right? It would make sense that they would try to compare pictures of Al-Qaeda guys with pictures from publicly available sources. I guess. But they don't just stick with publicly available sources, do they? No, they're hacking all the pictures that you send as attachments in your email. They're hacking whatever all pictures. Your pictures on Facebook that you put under your highest privacy settings and whatever else. They get whatever they want. Not just what Google Images would get, but anything that they can take. And as Glenn Greenwald puts it, this reveals, it's just another kind of window into the game that is being played here. They are trying to abolish privacy. When they say collect it all, they mean that any time a question comes up, they want to be able to pull up the damned answer on a computer and not have to ever get off their fat ass and go investigate it ever, because they already have total investigation of all people at all times. All they need to do to know the answer is to hit enter. We want to know everything that anyone knows about Joe. Enter. And up comes the complete file from every database in the world. And the NSA. That's what they want. Total. Not as hyperbole, not as a funny title, but as just a plain old adjective. Total information awareness. That's what they're doing. And, you know, I don't know, man, if this is even true. I guess I have to imagine that it's got to be at least partly true. I don't know. But NBC did this, did a poll that had More Americans opposed to Snowden than pro-Snowden. I'm getting this wrong, but it's really close within a couple of points. It was like 24% pro-Snowden, 34% anti-Snowden, and then 40% have no opinion. 40% have no opinion. Really? Now, that was the part that made me think, well, how did you guys ask this question? What the hell is this? 40% of Americans polled have no opinion. And then you know what I thought? Those are the liberal Democrats. Those are the people who love Obama. They just can't dare bring themselves to say, oh no, he's a traitor and I didn't have the right to know. Please spy on me and please don't warn me if I'm being spied on. But they can't just come out and say that he did the right thing when Dear Leader has instructed that officially good liberals and progressives do not support Edward Snowden because he broke the law. And Obama swears he was just about to do a reform thing on surveillance anyway. Remember that? You know, if you hadn't have done this, I would have had a reform that was I was going to announce it in like a couple of days. He said, he claimed. But anyway, you know, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I guess it is. I guess people really are still that terrified that they would rather be spied on. Does that make you feel better? You know, the reason it's so unreal to me is because it just doesn't make me feel better at all. And I'm probably more paranoid about Al-Qaeda right now than I have been in a long time. Whatever. Still no excuse to spy on you or me. The whole thing's crazy. It's still no excuse to have a national government at all. It's the number one reason to get rid of this government. It's Al-Qaeda's target anyway. It's dirty business is what's made an enemy out of them anyway. We should just abolish the U.S. state. And, you know, I guess part of this, too, is long before Al-Qaeda was really a known thing at all. I mean, I guess after the first World Trade Center bombing, but before any of the other Al-Qaeda attacks, I was already hip to this. I've already understood basically my entire, like, teenagehood and on that the entire telecommunications infrastructure of the United States of America was built with the NSA all along. Well, the NSA's been around since 1952, and of course, all their signals intelligence stuff existed before that, and all of the telecommunications infrastructure was all created after that, wasn't it? Come on, guys. Don't be an idiot. Of course they have a mirror on every backbone, on every fiber optic cable of any importance. Of course they have a switch that allows them to virtually read every bit of your mail if that's what they want to do. Did you think that they couldn't? Did you think that there was a law restraining them? So for me, I don't feel comforted by this at all. No, it just means that the horrible, evil, totalitarian government world empire of the United States of America that I hate anyway deserves to be hated just as much as I already hated it and deserves to be abolished maybe even more than I already wanted it abolished. How about damn them? How about the U.S. government is obviously, let's be clear about this, as the president would say, he and the U.S. government, they are the number one enemies of this country. You can't see that? 34% plus 40% just ain't certain whether or not Edward Snowden did the right thing for letting us know what the government is doing to us. I mean, talk about your Stockholm syndrome here. This is just, it's out of control, man. And see, here's the dissonance in my brain. One of the patches of neurons in my brain is screaming, it ain't true, man. Them MSNBC guys are damn liars. Everybody loves Snowden, the American hero. Are you kidding me? Yeah, everybody who's not a tax parasite, which is still most of us, right? Of course we love Snowden. But, you know, I don't know, man. at what can I do? I guess I could go through and do my very best examination of the poll data, but yeah. The fact is, if it's anywhere near 50-50, if it's not 70-30 or 80-20 pro-Snowden, pro-Greenwald, pro-this leak, and anti-state, then America is doomed. America has already blown its brains out. This is just the flopping around on the ground like some episode of South Park. This is just America crapping all over itself like Chef when he died. Americans don't think that they had the right to know? Americans aren't sure what to think of the clear-cut, altruistically motivated whistleblower who sacrificed everything to bring them this truth? That hurts, man. Except for the fact that I already knew that Americans sucked that bad. Otherwise, I'd be really disappointed right now.
Hey, all Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm writing a tweet. God dang it. Hang on a second. Also, see my interviews of him. Okay, there you go. Okay, so yeah, we're talking about Daniel Ellsberg. I'm trying to get him on the show, but I don't think it's going to work for today. But we'll have Dan on later this week at some point, okay? And the thing of it is that this ridiculous clown, John Kerry, I can't even say his name without, I just feel bad for the guy, kind of. Like, he's such an idiot. Hey, dude, why don't you ask your staffers what Dan Ellsberg thinks of Snowden before you go invoking Dan Ellsberg as a reason to condemn Snowden, you stupid ass. Now, Dan Ellsberg has an open invite on every channel. He's Dan Ellsberg. You can't deny him. You might deny any Snowden defender in America, but you can't deny Dan Ellsberg. He's like freaking George Washington or something. Even Republicans love Dan Ellsberg, except for Pat, which Pat ought to get over that, man. That's wrong, dude. Anyway, they gotta let Dan on. And the thing is about Dan is his IQ is about 290 or some kind of crap like that. And so, you know, those of you who've heard Dan on the show over the years, you know I have to beg him to stop for a follow-up question or for a commercial. And it's not because he's just blabbing on. It's because he's brilliant. It's because he speaks in 3,000-word article form, you know? He's just an incredibly bright guy. And so, you know, put him on CNN, put him on MSNBC, and give him a moment to refute John Kerry, and it's like a nuclear bomb, which is also an issue of Dan's. But anyway, so he's just been all over TV all weekend long and late last week, mocking and ridiculing the Secretary of State's position on Edward Snowden and whether he should come home and face the music. And Dan says, listen, I should have never been charged in the first place. Freedom of speech, man. And Edward Snowden should be charged either. But at least back in 1971, 72, 73, Dan Ellsberg, from the time that he was arrested, he was able to bond out, and then he spent 3 years giving speeches, giving press conferences, writing articles, explaining, defending himself to the public, explaining why he did what he did. Of course, if you're not familiar, Dan Ellsberg is the heroic former Marine officer and then Rand Corporation analyst who leaked the Pentagon Papers, the secret, real, true Pentagon history of the Vietnam War that he had helped to write
mostly in collaboration with Leslie Gelb, who you may recognize as a former president of the Council on Foreign Relations, as the guy who said, yes, it's true, I went along with the Iraq War because it was good for my career. The anti-Ellsberg, in other words, Leslie Gelb. Pathetic rat. But anyway, heroic truth teller, Dan Ellsberg. Unlike that rat Gelb, he liberated the papers. He told the American people that, yeah, we've been lying to you this whole time, and we knew we were lying to you this whole time. And the reason we were lying to you this whole time is so you would let us continue doing the horrible things that we were doing. If you knew the truth, you would have made us stop. So anyway, here's Dan Ellsberg going on TV and saying, when I was charged under the Espionage Act, which I should have never been charged under, I had the opportunity to go around and defend myself. If Edward Snowden was arrested and charged under the Espionage Act now, he would be in solitary confinement, probably for the rest of his life. He wouldn't get a chance to make his case, as he's doing now, at all. And if he ever went to trial, he would have the furthest thing from some kind of, you know, TV movie, open court trial, like you were brainwashed and lied into believing was real on TV and in government school your whole life. He would not have the opportunity, and this is 100% fact, that's it. He would not have the opportunity to argue in his defense, but I did it for good reasons, Judge. I was blowing the whistle and telling the truth to the people. He would not even be allowed to say that. The jury would not be allowed to hear that. The jury would be allowed to hear only that he took these secrets, and that's it. He would not be allowed to defend himself. And so, since he can't get a fair trial because this isn't a free country and it does not have a rule of law, why should he be obligated to man up? It's just like Michael Kinsley's argument that Greenwald can't decide what gets published. And by Greenwald, he meant or Risen or Gelman or any reporter in America should not get to decide. Only the government should get to decide what's secret and what's not secret. Because after all, despite what Glenn Greenwald says, it's still a democracy, wrote Michael Kinsley. Well, how the hell is it a democracy if the people don't know what the government is doing? And therefore are not able to judge their representatives as to whether they're actually representing them or not, because everything that the government, that the representatives control, is done in secret. Everything that they do is done in secret. You know what the hell I'm trying to say. And even if it is a democracy, and representatives are elected and then they so-called have some oversight over the millions of appointees and hirees in the executive branch, and therefore the American people had no right to review what secret ever other than what that same executive branch declassifies, because we have Dianne Feinstein up there on the Senate Intelligence Committee to protect us. This is such idiocy. You see these Obama defenders, they pretend to just be critics of Snowden, when what they really are is religious believers in the divinity of dear leader, the Democrat, whose team they're on. And so they tried to say, I got a big fight yesterday on Twitter about this with some Obama bots, about, oh, well, Snowden, there's no reason to believe that he really wrote all these critical emails to his bosses and blew the whistle internally. Well, yeah, there is. They admit they publish at least one email that they denied existed at all. So that means that they're proven liars now that they've decided to change their story. And then they publish only one, even though he very particularly describes the emails that he sent and who he sent them to and what they were about. So they're the admitted liars on this issue of whether he had blown the whistle inside the NSA at all or not. And meanwhile, what an entirely red herring. When the entire argument here, for anyone who's paid attention whatsoever, is that they have reinterpreted the law to mean that they can do whatever they want. This is not George Bush saying, I can break the law because I'm the president and I have the inherent plenary authority as president to break the law. That's not what it is. They have now, what they've done is they've taken the Patriot Act and they held it down and they raped it until it said that government can do anything it wants. That's not what it says in the Patriot Act, but now they say that's what it says. And that goes for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. That goes for the director of the National Security Agency and all of its top lawyers. And that goes for the leaders of the intelligence committees in both houses of Congress. So they are all in on the conspiracy to defy the Constitution, to, frankly, to lie about what the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendments Act say and the authority granted to them in those laws. So who was he supposed to blow the whistle to? He was supposed to tattletale to Keith Alexander that Keith Alexander was breaking the law? You know, whistleblowing inside, that means, you know, your sixth-level supervisor's breaking the law. And then you try to tell his supervisor and his supervisor about, geez, they're spying on their girlfriends, guys. But that's not what this is about. This is about the American people, the actual bosses under the presumption of popular sovereignty, you know, consent of the governed. This is our republic, not theirs. We created it to serve our purposes, to secure our liberty and happiness. Security and happiness. He had to tell us on what the bosses were doing. Idiots. Obama bots. Is there a lower form of life outside of the Republican Party, you know? Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X Key Score, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy. The Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, Reza Marashi from the National Iranian American Council will be on to talk about the nuclear deal. And Phil Giraldi to talk about covert action in Syria. And what the hell all is going on there, man? I don't know. Anyway. One more thing about Ellsberg here, and this is what brought it up, actually, was over there on the Twitter. The conversation's going on about why it was that Daniel Ellsberg did not get life in prison. Because under the Espionage Act, the unconstitutional Espionage Act, he was guilty. So how come he didn't get life in prison for leaking the Pentagon Papers? Which he was prepared to do. Not that he wanted to do life in prison. And the answer is because of the corruption of Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon actually hired Cuban hitmen to murder Daniel Ellsberg. They were to kill him at a speech he was giving, a press conference he was giving. Was it at the Supreme Court steps? It was at some courthouse steps, maybe not the Supreme Court. Some kind of courthouse steps in D.C. They were supposed to incapacitate him totally, which means murder him. But they didn't have a clean shot, and so they left, and so that was that. But that came out, and I believe the way I remember it, either from the book or from the way it was described to me by Dan himself, I think it was the federal prosecutor, the U.S. attorney, who came forward with the information, said, look, we found this out, and of course, we have to let you know about this. We have to let the court know about this. And then, I guess, right around the same time, I'm not certain exactly what order this happened in, but Nixon administration officials came to the judge and told him, we're considering you for a U.S. Supreme Court appointment. Wouldn't that be great? And he said, yeah, that'd be great. Awesome. Okay, good deal. Let's shake hands. I think he even kind of gave him an interview and talked about, yeah, this is what I believe. And then at some point it occurred to him, hey, you guys are trying to bribe me into coming down hard on Daniel Ellsberg. And I think at that point, who knows this judge? He was a judge, so I don't give him the benefit of the doubt. He's guilty till proven innocent to me, son of a bitch. Federal judge. How many innocent people had he helped destroy in his life? Conspirator. Against mankind. But in this case, I guess he judged that the Nixon administration was a sinking ship and he wasn't going to get on board it. Too late for that. And so he let Dan Ellsberg go and dismissed all the charges against him. That said, that's just too much interference in the judicial process. And now there's a point of contention here because my interlocutor here on Twitter is saying, yeah, but I always thought it was they broke into the psychiatrist's office. Wasn't that the official reason that they gave? And I don't think so. But I could be wrong, and I think the answer is in the book Secrets. And my plan is to have Dan on the show later this week, so maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that a little bit later this week. And I'll see if I can ask him. But I've talked with Dan Ellsberg repeatedly since, you know, probably 25 times or something like that in the past 10 years. And he's told me this story quite a few times. And I'm pretty sure it was the hitmen and the USSC proposal there that really did in the prosecution. And the judge, at some point, even a federal judge has got to be like, come on, man. I could get in trouble if I take a Supreme Court spot and it's so blatantly obvious that I crucify Ellsberg for you. Forget it, man. Nobody's going to buy that. Everybody's going to see through that, you know? Let me say one more thing about Dan Ellsberg, and that is the last time I tried to call him and get him on the show to come on to talk about Snowden, it was before the John Kerry thing, which he's decided to come forward and respond to, but it was just last week. Wasn't it just last week? Beginning of last week, or maybe it was the end of the week before that or something. I tried to get him on, and he said, you know, I'm really busy writing my book. And I said, oh, by all means, go back to your authorship, sir. I'm just happy to know that you're writing. Thank you. Because you know what he's writing about? He's writing about nuclear weapons. He's writing about how, why in the world do we allow politicians to own nuclear weapons? What, are we crazy? You know, Richard Nixon actually said at one point during the worst of the Watergate scandal, he just mused aloud to the journalists there, to the White House press corps, and I think it may have been a subtle threat that, you know, I could go in there and make one phone call and in 15 minutes, 70 million people would be killed or would be dead. And of course, that's true. And I think that the reporters at the time, when they heard him say that, they thought to themselves, holy crap, this guy is drunk. He is bummed. He is freaking, man. We got to get him the hell out of here now. But who in the world could elect anyone to have that much authority over anyone? It's madness. Popular sovereignty. What? You know, this is something, especially during the Bush years, you heard talk like this. Let the whole world vote who gets to be the American president. It affects everybody. Of course, I'm not for that, but let's think about what it means that, you know, whatever percentage of the 300 million of us in America that actually show up to vote, that get to choose between a couple of sock puppets of the J.P. Morgan Chase or Lockheed, Martin, Marietta, McDonnell, whatever the hell it all is combined now. We're choosing who gets to sit on thousands of H-bombs. These guys who would just as soon turn around and provoke Vladimir Putin. Yeah, boy, two V's and two words in a row and I'm doomed, right? I'm supposed to be able to talk through that. These guys would just as soon pick a fight with Vladimir Putin, who also has thousands of H-bombs. And this is the single most important story in the world, the single most important issue in the world, the single most important thing ever in the history of the whole world. Other than, I guess, maybe that one natural disaster that bottlenecked humanity down to just a few thousand, they say, right? Before they started growing again. That could have been the extinction of man right there. But Second place to that, and we came through that, so good. But, yeah, H-bombs? Lawrence Wittner has a thing today. It has too much one-world communism in it for me, but he makes some great points about, you know, it was just one tiny little old 10-kiloton atom bomb that killed all of Hiroshima, destroyed an entire city. And, you know, the Nagasaki bomb killed fewer, but that was because of the terrain there, mostly, and that kind of thing. But that was a little bit bigger bomb with slightly less casualties, still destroyed the entire city. But one of those is, as Daniel Ellsberg puts it, just the blasting cap. One of those is just the blasting cap, the percussion cap that sets off an H-bomb that makes it as hot as the sun so that you can fuse hydrogen atoms together and, you know, kill Houston, Texas, not just little bitty old Hiroshima, but even a city like Houston in a single shot. That's the most important journalism being done in the world right now, is Daniel Ellsberg and the book he's writing. Check him out at Truth Dig.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back. So here on page 451 of Secrets, let's see, the reason for Nixon's involvement. Oh, this is Secrets, a memoir of Vietnam and the Pentagon Papers by Daniel Ellsberg. The reason for Nixon's direct involvement as early as June 23rd, 1972, and continuing, had turned out to be his concern to keep Howard Hunt from revealing the earlier fielding break-in and other illegal actions of the plumbers. As I later learned, Ellsberg writes, the burglary of my psychoanalyst's office in September 1971, though best known, was not the last or most dramatic of these. 8 months later, on May 3, 1972, on orders from Colson to Liddy and Hunt, the White House secretly flew a dozen Cuban-American CIA assets from Miami to Washington to disrupt a rally that I and others were addressing on the steps of the Capitol and to assault me physically. And let me continue here for a second. I don't find the money quote here. Maybe I only heard that. No, yeah, it gets better here. This was the rally described earlier, 5 days before the mining of Haiphong and 8 days after Senator Gravel had released an SSM-1 to the press. I guess that was, you know, part of it or something. Part of the Pentagon Papers. The purpose of the planned assault on me remains obscure. However, an Oval Office tape of May 2nd reveals that Nixon was aware I had chosen this moment to reveal NSSM-1 at last. Whatever else I had from NSC files could be presumed to be on the verge of disclosure. According to Nick Ackerman, the attorney on the Watergate Special Prosecution Task Force, who investigated this incident with over 100 interviews, some members of the team from Miami had orders, quote, to incapacitate me totally. You know, me in brackets there. To incapacitate Ellsberg totally. Quote, unquote. Different members of the team had different perspectives on their functions. All of them reported that Hunt and Liddy had shown them my picture and that of Bill Kunstler also at the rally and told them I was the target. Several told the FBI or WSPTF that that's the Watergate Special Prosecution Task Force, that as one put it to time, we were to call him traitor and punch him in the nose. Bernard Barker, who with Eugenio Martinez recruited the team in Miami, told the journalist Lloyd Shearer later that his orders had been to break both my legs. The team found the crowd too friendly to me to make it safe to carry out their mission. Some of them instead assaulted young participants on the edge of the crowd and were led away by police. And then, so, there's that. And then, I'm trying to find the part about the bribery of the judge. But, yeah, there's no question that incapacitate Dan Ellsberg totally means kill him. Give me a break.
And then, you know, it's hard to scan through an article live, but let me read to you just a little bit about of what the judge said as he dismissed the charges against Ellsberg. He said, commencing on April 26th, the government has made an extraordinary series of disclosures regarding the conduct of several governmental agencies regarding the defendants in this case. Much information has been developed, but new information has produced new questions, and there remain more questions than answers. The disclosures made by the government demonstrate that governmental agencies have taken an unprecedented series of actions with respect to these defendants. After the original indictment, at a time when the government's rights to investigate the defendants are narrowly circumscribed, the White House officials established a special unit to investigate one of the defendants in this case. We have been given only a glimpse of what the special unit did regarding this case, but what we have seen is more than disquieting. And I believe, and he continues on there, but I believe that that includes I believe the way Dan Ellsberg explained it to me on the show was that, it was the bribery, the offer that will appoint you to the Supreme Court, as well as the hit. So let me just tweet this guy here live in real time while I'm in the middle of doing a radio show, Secrets, page 451, for the hit. All right. So, hey, somebody asked me for a footnote. I provide it. And I'm doing my best. I keep calling him during the break, but I'm getting voicemail, man. But I'm going to have Dan Ellsberg on the show later this week, and then we'll get out to take care of that. Okay. Yes, this is how I do my radio show. I check my bookshelf for my footnotes in real time, live on the show. Because I'm not very good at broadcasting, but I am very good at footnotes. Oh, yeah. Okay. So, I'm Scott. This is my show. If you want to hang out in the chat room, hang out in the chat room, man. It's scotthorton.org/chat. And we got a good group of guys in there, and they're all talking with each other about things that they like talking about. Mostly about how right I am about everything, which, you know, probable enough. scotthorton.org/chat. Well, I'm going to have Phil Giraldi on to talk about the Syria thing. I mean, this really should have been the top headline, right? Is the Brussels shooter who murdered two people at a, I think two Israelis at a Jewish something or other, a museum or a community center or something. I'm sorry on the details. Doesn't matter. Matters is the guy was an ISIS, Al-Qaeda jihadist. Originally, I believe, a Frenchman. Or at least recently a Frenchman, went and spent some time fighting with the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham. And or, you know, Syria, however you call it. And I think that's the first big blowback from Syria in the West. And I'm afraid it's a harbinger of things to come. If you heard the interview of Michael Scheuer, and you heard me talking a lot in that interview, and it was about how, man, I'm pretty damned alarmed about this. You know, I was explaining to Eric Garris at antiwar.com about how if I had one real regret about my politics of the 90s, I mean, I learned a lot, but I was so much more of a kind of a conspiracy theorist type. I mean, I was great on Waco and the Oklahoma bombing as a result, but I was wrong about a lot of crap, too. I was chasing red herrings. After Clinton bombed Serbia, I should have known that bringing Russia into NATO was not in the cards, and that whole one world government thing was just, that doesn't fit with what's going on here, man. So try again. It took me too long. But here's the thing about it, is I've known about Al-Qaeda since 1996. I mean, I was interested in the first World Trade Center bombing, if only because the media wasn't, because everybody's name was so difficult to pronounce and stuff, and they weren't interested in the story. There's so much other stuff going on. And, you know, of course, you had the entire Waco catastrophe started 2 days after the first World Trade Center bombing. And, the thing of it is that, if I could go back and have my 1990s again, I would have been much more obsessed with Al-Qaeda. I know what I was going to say. I saw the interview on CNN in 96.
I forget if it was Peter Arnett or Peter Bergen or which one of them, but both of them interviewed bin Laden. And I saw that in 96, and I read about him in Newsweek. You know, this rich Saudi sort of prince guy who seems to really mean business and, you know, seems to be connected to these, those, and the other attacks. And my problem is I should have been better on Al-Qaeda in the lead-up to 9/11. And I should have been better on how crappy my government was when all they do all day is make enemies for the American people and they do nothing to protect us from them. And then use every crisis as the excuse to just keep doing more of the same, only worse, and to more people. It's horrible. And, I don't know. What if there had been me and 15 other, you know, just regular private citizens had just decided that we were obsessed with Al-Qaeda and we're obsessed with writing little pamphlets about it and little mini books about it and getting on radio shows about it and accusing the FBI and the CIA of not working together about it and the NSA too. I sort of feel like it's 98, 99 right now. Like, there's a big one coming, and the FBI is too busy entrapping some idiot to stop it. There are thousands of these guys all over the freaking place now. Who's going to hold them back? Uncle Sam? Who made them?
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.
All right, guys. Yeah, I've been waxing on and on too long about too many things for too many segments in a row. I'm going to move fast now because I only got one more segment left to talk and for the interviews start. Actually, Reza might only be a 10-minute interview now that I think about it. I guess we'll see what happens there. I don't know. I'm starting to think of lots of different things I could ask him, though, now that I think about it, you know? I don't know. I guess it depends on how long he wants to answer stuff. Reza Marashi coming up from the National Iranian American Council. And then Phil Giraldi, he's formerly CIA, formerly DIA. He's the executive director of the Council for the National Interest, which sponsors this show. And he's anti-war conservative. He's some kind of, I don't know. I think he doesn't call himself a conservative anymore because of what conservatives are. But anyway, he's good on all this stuff, man. So I'm going to have him on. You know what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell him, you know what, Shoyer scared the crap out of me. Talk me down from my paranoia about Al-Qaeda, and then we're going to see what he says. But I just can't ignore the fact that George Bush and his co-conspirators who lied us into war with Iraq, that what they've done has been the greatest thing that anyone could have ever done for Osama bin Laden. And that as a result, as was predicted and explained back then, we now have, and recently again, we have gigantic lawless jihadi stands all through the Sunni provinces of Iraq and into Syria and then, of course, across North Africa. And everybody's playing on the monkey bars with Boko Haram now, so they're all in too. And it seems like it could be a real problem. A real problem. We went from a couple hundred Al-Qaeda guys to now, 12, 13 years later, we got thousands of Al-Qaeda guys. How many thousand? I don't know. And maybe that's not that big of a deal. But it kind of seems like it could be, man. Especially when you've got so many people in the West radicalized who have then now gone. You didn't see much of this during Iraq, right? But now you have all these guys from Europe going to Syria to fight in this one. And then, so how many of them, like this Brussels shooter, can get back onto the continent, travel around, hit soft targets wherever they want? How many of them can fly under the radar and get a visa and get in the United States? There was an American did a suicide bombing in Syria the other day. What if he'd come back and done it here? And you know what? You don't have to have much imagination. All you have to do is be a red-blooded male, and you can imagine how to hurt large groups of people at a soft target somewhere. You could imagine how one could, right, take a rifle to a ball game. I hope I'm not giving any Al-Qaeda guys ideas they didn't already have. But if someone, if a very small number of people wanted to really terrorize the hell out of the American people, they sure could. They wanted to provoke an absolutely lawless totalitarian reaction. They could. If they wanted to provoke a full-scale invasion of the Middle East, they could. The action is in the reaction, and the Americans, you know, they keep making these unenforced errors on this jihadist thing, man. And you know what? It's so easy to look at it from Bush and Cheney's point of view, from David Addington and Scooter Libby and Ariel Sharon's point of view. Al-Qaeda. These guys are nothing. They make the greatest excuse ever, right? This one, you know, 18th century sized ship full of pirates gets to be the excuse, the endless, list of baseball card, right? They even use baseball cards. Endless list of Emmanuel Goldsteins to serve as the boogeyman. Bin Laden and his 900 number three men. And so since they never took it seriously and they just went and do what they want to do, look what they've done now. And man, you know what? I better pull this up before the interview. See, I said I was going to cover all this news, but I got to make sure I don't forget this. So here, let's see. It was Obama's interview with Jeffrey Goldberg, where they talked about Syria and Iran. Oh, this is great because they talk about how I think it was in the Atlantic. Yeah, it was not in Bloomberg. It was in the Atlantic. Obama to Iran and Israel as president of the United States. I don't bluff. Yeah, he's going to stop Iran from getting a nuclear bomb that they're not even trying to get and never have been trying to get in any of our whole lives. But anyway, so here in the interview, they talk about Syria. And let me get my highlighter working here. Oh, my highlighter didn't want to work. My highlighter doesn't want to work, everybody. All right, well, I got to find Syria here. From Syria. Oh, so here we go. Jeffrey Goldberg, former Israeli prison guard in the Palestinian occupied territories, right-wing pro-war monger, helped lie us into war with Iraq back in 2002 and 2003 with his phony stories about connections between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. A literal, damned liar. Horrible journalist. Arab-hating bigot. You know, Israel's man at the Atlantic. So anyway, so here's what he says, is he's talking with President Barack Obama here. They're talking about Syria. And what's funny is that none of them pretend to care about the people of Syria at all in the entire conversation. It's Barack Obama. He's talking with a right-winger, so he's got no reason to invoke it. Jeffrey Goldberg sure as hell doesn't care about the life of a single Lebanese. So it doesn't even occur to him. And it doesn't occur to either of them to pretend for a minute, because I guess they just kind of forgot. So Goldberg says, and this is the first place in the interview where Syria comes up, can you just talk about Syria as a strategic issue? Talk about it as a humanitarian. Oh, no, he does bring it up. Oh, I guess he brings it up and Obama doesn't take that bait. Talk about it as a humanitarian issue as well. But it would seem to me that the only way to weaken and further isolate Iran is to remove or help remove Iran's only Arab ally. President Obama replies, quote, absolutely. Goldberg responds. And so the question is, what else can this administration be doing? Well, look, there's no doubt, President Obama replies, that Iran is much weaker now than it was a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. The Arab Spring, as bumpy as it has been, represents a strategic defeat for Iran. because what people in the region have seen is that all the impulses toward freedom and self-determination and free speech and freedom of assembly have been constantly violated by Iran. The Iranian leadership, is no friend of that movement toward human rights and political freedom. But more directly, it is now engulfing Syria, and Syria is basically their only true ally in the region. And it is our estimation that President Bashar al-Assad's days are numbered. It is not a matter of if, but when. This is Obama 2 years ago. It's not a matter of if, but when. Now, can we accelerate that? We're working with the world community to try to do that. It is complicated by the fact that Syria is a much bigger, much more sophisticated, much more complicated country than Libya, for example. The opposition is hugely splintered. That although there's unanimity within the Arab world at this point, internationally, countries like Russia are still blocking potential UN mandates or action. And so what we're trying to do, and the Secretary of State just came back from helping to lead the Friends of Syria group in Tunisia, is to try to come up with a series of strategies that can help provide humanitarian relief, but they can also accelerate a transition to a peaceful and stable representative Syrian government. If that happens, that will be a profound loss for Iran. So I guess I blew it in my setup. They both give the slightest lip service to humanitarianism. But clearly the entire motivation is... See, I fess up when I screw up, unlike everyone else. But I'm still right anyway, which is great, because I'm never that wrong, just a tiny bit. In fact, I'm glad that they brought it up the way they brought it up, because they both brought it up just to touch that base and pretend that they gave a crap for 1 second. The entire conversation is, wouldn't it help us weaken Iran if we can regime change Syria? That's the question, and the answer is, oh, hell yeah. And then he gives... 500-word answer here about how that's the right answer. This is why Obama has supported al-Qaeda in Syria. To weaken Iran. Because that's what Israel wants. Bush paid Syria to torture al-Qaeda guys. Obama pays the al-Qaeda guys to fight against the Syrian government. It's treason. It's treason.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today, corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson, available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Hang on 1 sec now here. Well, I know what I'll do. I'll play a couple of clips for you to entertain you a little bit while I try to make a phone call here. It ain't my fault. It's somebody else's fault.
Now that the war is over and there's some difficulty with the peace, was it worth doing?
I think it was unquestionably worth doing, Charlie. And I think that looking back, I now certainly feel I understand more what the war was about. We needed to go over there, basically, and take out a very big stick right in the heart of that world and burst that bubble. And there was only one way to do it. And what they needed to see was American boys and girls going house to house from Basra to Baghdad, and basically saying, which part of this sentence don't you understand? You don't think, you know, we care about our open society? You think this bubble fantasy, we're just going to let it grow? Well, suck on this, okay? That, Charlie, was what this war was about. We could have hit Saudi Arabia. It was part of that bubble. Could have hit Pakistan. We hit Iraq because we could. That's the real truth.
Yeah, there you go. And it's funny, too, the way he says Baghdad to Basra, where all Shiites live and zero bin Ladenites, not a single bin Ladenite anywhere between Baghdad and Basra. If you had to pick a land where Arabs live, and yet none of them admire bin Laden at all, that's the area. But anyway, that's why Thomas Friedman is the most celebrated public intellectual in the United States of America. He only found out why he supported the war after it had already started. But anyway, that's good enough for him. I guess it'll be good enough for us, too. Now we go to our friend Reza Marashi. He's at the National Iranian American Council. That's NIAcouncil.org. And what they do is they push for peace between the U.S. and Iran. And I'm down with that. Welcome back to the show. Reza, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, I never get this right in your introduction. Could you please tell us what was the name of your job when you worked in the U.S. State Department?
Yeah, I worked in the Office of Iranian Affairs at the U.S. Department of State, you know, covering a range of issues everywhere from democracy, human rights, internal politics, foreign policy, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, right on. I like to remind people that, remind myself. It's very good. Okay, so now here's the thing of it, a little bit of background. They made, hallelujah, unbelievable. This is a major step. I don't think anybody could really overstate it. Maybe I could, but most people couldn't overstate the importance of the fact that last November, the Americans and the rest of the UN Security Council, including the permanent members and including Germany, the P5 plus one, they struck a deal with the Iranians that said, here's our interim deal toward working toward a final deal. But in the meantime, while we're working on our final deal, you will do these steps and we will do those steps and all of that. So now that's been last November. Here we are. It's the beginning of June. We're nearing the point where they're supposed to be able to come up with a kind of final deal here. So I was hoping that you could give the audience a brief rundown. What was the deal, basically, in not too small of a nutshell, but what was the interim deal? How well it's being implemented now? Any discrepancies or crises we need to know about? And then I hope we can get into talking about the final deal, its probable shape, and the probabilities that it will take shape at all.
Sure. I think the important things to point out about the interim nuclear deal that was signed in November and went into implementation in January, there's two points on both sides that I think are important to point out, one side being the United States, or the P5 plus one, as you pointed out, and the other side being Iran. On the U.S. or P5 plus one side, they were able to give Iran some sanctions relief. I think a total of a couple of billion dollars over the next 6 months, or over the six-month duration of the interim deal. But more important than the sanctions relief was that they finally acknowledged that if a final comprehensive nuclear deal is struck, there will be enrichment on Iranian soil. And what that enrichment of uranium on Iranian soil will look like will be mutually defined, they said. And that was a pretty big shift because neither the Bush administration nor Obama in his first term were willing to go that far. And I think that's something that the Iranians were able to sink their teeth into. Now, on the Iranian side, they obviously made some very significant limitations to the nuclear program that they have. For example, they stopped enriching uranium to the 20% level. Very difficult to go from 0% to 20%. Much easier to go from 20% to 90%, which would be needed for a weapon should Iran in the future decide to make that decision. They haven't since 2003, according to U.S. intelligence. And the other thing that they did is they diluted the stockpile of 20% enriched uranium, meaning they had a stockpile of a certain number of kilograms, and that stockpile is going to be reduced to zero in about a month and a half's time, if not already. So that's significant. That means you take something that the United States and its allies viewed as a proliferation risk, and you further reduce that risk because the actual concrete, tangible items that Iran has in its nuclear program have been significantly reduced. There were other details, on both sides, but just so the listeners get an idea of what the real meat on the bones was, I think those things were the most important.
Mm. All right, so now a couple of things here. First of all, it is... Well, yeah, let's go back over what you say about how important it is that the Americans have said, I guess they haven't really yet, but in effect, they have accepted enrichment by saying that they will accept enrichment. And at best,
really, since the beginning of the Obama administration, they've implied that they would accept enrichment, but they never have outright said that. And so that really is a big deal. I could see why that would be a real big deal to the Iranians. But then, am I right that they're really far apart on just how many centrifuges, will remain spinning under the New Deal or limits on the expansion of new facilities or anything like that? It seems like there's a lot of ground to be made up there.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one way of putting it. Another way of putting it is they're negotiating. And any two parties that are sitting down to negotiate, whether it's the P5 plus one in Iran or two businessmen or anyone in between, you know, they're going to start out with their respective maximalist positions, meaning, you know, if you had a gymnasium, let's say, for example, the United States would be at one end of the gymnasium, Iran would be at the other end of the gymnasium. The idea is that through the course of negotiations, you meet at half court. So that way, you're making compromises. Both sides get more than they would get without any kind of compromise, but neither side gets everything that they want. But through compromising and getting a little bit more than you would get otherwise, that's better than the alternative, the status quo, which is moving both sides to the precipice of war. And I think that's something that both sides would independently seek to avoid. So, you know, between now and July 20th, which is the soft deadline, which they hope to get this all done by, there's going to be a lot of posturing. There's going to be a lot of blame game, a lot of spin, trying to shape the narrative in the media about, you know, who's more at fault or who needs to compromise more. You're already seeing that in the United States, and I think you're going to start to see it more in Iran. But at the end of the day, the moral of the story is both sides have to compromise in order for this to work. Both sides think that they're approaching this from a position of strength. The reality is that neither side is as strong as they think they are. And over time, I think they've slowly started to realize that, but not quite enough that's necessary to get the deal. And I think that's what the next month to month and a half is really going to be about, is kind of like a game of chicken, where, you know, those old James Dean movies where two cars are driving towards the end of the cliff to see who hits the brakes first.
Yeah.
That's basically what they're doing now in this negotiation. But neither side wants this to fail.
Yeah. Well, now, so here's the thing about it, is that all these guys remind me of used car salesmen, so I'm cool with them negotiating. And it seems like, well, you know, I don't know. When the discrepancy between the number of centrifuges each side will agree to is that vast, I'm perfectly, you know, I'm totally cool with, okay, well, here's where we're going to have our major compromise. This is really the crux of the issue anyway. But then the Americans go bringing up missiles. Missiles for nuclear bombs that aren't being made, and that we're completely diminishing. The whole goal here is to diminish even the possibility of an Iranian nuclear weapons threat to such a degree that we'll be willing to lift our sanctions and maybe even begin to get along in other ways, maybe. And yet, we got to bring up missiles. Is that just some more used car salesmanship? And now the damn music's playing. We got to go to break. Hang on 1 second, Reza. We'll be right back, everybody. It's Reza Marashi from NIAcouncil.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richmond, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richmond, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. It's the Scott Horton Show. We're on Liberty Radio Network at lrn.fm and at scotthorton.org. Join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. We're talking with Reza Marashi. He's formerly with the U.S. State Department, the Iran desk there, as you heard him say. And now he's at the National Iranian American Council. That's niacouncil.org there with Trita Parsi and others, doing great work pushing for peace between the U.S. and Iran, a real detente between the U.S. and Iran, and thank goodness for that. And so now, what I was trying to say, and I was overly explaining the hell out of it, Rez, but I was just saying, wheeling and dealing is one thing, and arguing over the numbers, spinning centrifuges is one thing, but I'm worried, and I'm channeling a little Gareth Porter here, I'm worried that the demands that, oh yeah, now you have to bring your missiles up for negotiation too, is a poison pill, that this is sabotage, that this is sort of like 2005, where now they're going to blow up the damn deal. Right when they could have a deal, they're going to blow up their own deal for whatever stupid political reasons here, rather than do the right thing and finally end this stupid Cold War. But I know you're more optimistic than that, so let's hear it. Talk me down.
Well, I think that there are some in the United States and Europe that do want to put missiles on the table. Israel and Saudi Arabia, I'm sure, want to do the same. But there are enough smart people in all of those places that have articulated very clearly that if you don't have the fissile material produced by enriching uranium to put into a missile, then ballistic missiles are not a non-proliferation threat. They're not a nuclear weapons threat. They're not a delivery system for a nuclear weapon if you don't actually have the material to put into the missile. So in the bigger scheme of things, while there are some people that are making that argument that they should be on the table, and the United States has brought up the issue in the negotiations, you know, Tehran has said unequivocally and repeatedly that this shouldn't be an issue. Fortunately, there are current and former officials in the West that that understand that, you know, maybe now isn't the time to discuss this issue. Maybe you discuss it a little on down the line and really slay the wolf nearest the sled here in terms of getting done what the lowest hanging fruit is, because frankly, there isn't that much low hanging fruit, and the negotiations are tough enough as is. Mm-hmm. So the missile issue is real, but there are people that are overhyping it, I think.
Right. All right. Now, so the Iraq reactor, that is the one that produces, that can produce weapons grade plutonium as a byproduct, even though they do not have the very fancy facility that they would need to reprocess it as such, and even though they have a deal with the Russians to take care of any waste material out of there. I think that's the situation going into this negotiation. But so what's at dispute about Iraq in the negotiation, Reza? Can you tell me?
Well, I think that originally the dispute centered on the fact that Iran didn't need a heavy water facility help produce energy and produce other peaceful measures within its program, broadly conceived, right? And the Iranians said, well, if we want to, we can, but if this is a concern for you, there are ways to reconfigure the facility without shutting it down, without mothballing it, so that it does not run the same kind of proliferation risk that Western countries had originally perceived. That's something that the Iranians have on numerous occasions stated that they're amenable to doing, and that's what they're in the process of negotiating now. So they've actually made progress on the issue from where we were 6 months ago. Right. And frankly, it's a facility that hasn't even been fully constructed yet.
Right.
So we're talking about something that's in the offing.
Right.
But the Iranians have given their negotiators quite a bit of leash in terms of trying to provide enough flexibility to get this thing done. And so too has the United States. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that it's not fully understood to the degree that it should be here that, you know, yes, the United States is negotiating, but so is Iran. Like, this succeeds if both sides compromise, and it fails if one side isn't willing to compromise. So if it's gotten this far, I think we need to give both sides credit and encourage them to continue so that that failure is less and less a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and now what about the facility at COM, the Fordo facility, where they had been doing at least some of the enriching, or was it all of the enrichment up to 20%? U-235 was taking place at COM. What's its future, and how much of it is up for negotiation?
Well, this is what they're parsing through right now. Originally, the United States wanted Iran to shut down this particular facility because it was buried underground and it was much less able to be bombed, for lack of a better term, right? The United States probably has bunker busters that can get it, but, you know, that's neither here nor there because the United States doesn't want to drop bunker busting bombs on Iran. The Iranians said, we're not going to close this facility. What we can do is open it up to inspections, increase the verification mechanisms that are in place so that the International Atomic Energy Agency can see what's going on in the facility, and we can negotiate over what the actual construct of the facility will look like. Will it be a research and design facility? Will it be a uranium enrichment facility? What does that look like? That's what they're negotiating over right now. But I think you've gone from a position that Iran had a little over a year ago, which is nothing about this facility is negotiable, to today, where they're actually negotiating what it's going to look like in the future, that's progress. So
Right.
Again, flexibility should beget flexibility, and that's why we're almost 6 months in and making progress, not understanding that it is a very tough negotiation process any way you slice it.
Right. All right, and now, so I brought up 2005 before, and, you know, I guess in my impression, the Iranians were really hoping that they could get a deal, although I don't think they were being, you know, fools about it when the Bush administration refused to participate in the negotiations at all, but just sent the so-called E3, Britain, France, and Germany, to negotiate on their behalf and all of that. But I guess, you know, it was pretty obvious at the time for any of us cynics that, you know, the E3 can't get a deal without American support, and so there's not going to be a deal here, and so this is all, you know, it's like the Israeli-Palestinian talks or whatever, like, yeah, we're going through this again, but nobody really even believes at the beginning that it'll go anywhere at the end. So I just, and this is more of a speculative sort of gut feeling sort of a question for you, Reza, is just whether you really think that the political establishments, which is oversimplifying it, of course, there are different factions in both countries and all, but whether you think that the, you know, major force with the political establishments in each country really want to see this thing through this time, or whether, you know, there's still kind of that, you know, residue of just, it's all just a charade, it's the same old American BS.
Well, I don't think this is the same old American BS if we're referencing the Bush administration for comparison. You know, what the Obama administration...
Well, or Obama. I mean, Obama pretended to outcome 4 days after they declared it in order to scotch his own push for negotiations back in 2009 and that kind of thing. So he hasn't... And after the Turkish and the Brazilians, when they did exactly what he asked to try to strike a deal, he then denied it and screwed them over back in 2010, and you know...
Yeah, well, there's enough blame to go around. You know, we could sit here and put together a laundry list of missed opportunities that Washington and Tehran have pissed away. But looking forward, which is what I think we all should do, we have a very real opportunity. You know, the Obama administration has taken steps that no previous American administration since 1979 has taken. And the Iranians have taken steps that no previous Iranian administration has taken. So yeah, sure. You know, the dustbin of history is littered with missed opportunities. That's one of the great tragedies of U.S.-Iran relations over the past three decades. But we finally have a very real chance, fragile as it might be, to overcome the obstacles that have been in, you know, preventing us from finding a peaceful solution to the
Reza,
conflict.
Reza, I can't tell you how much I appreciate the work that you're doing. You and Trita and the rest of them. It's niacouncil.org. Thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
I love this song. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And next up is our friend Phil Giraldi. He's formerly CIA and DIA, and now he's the executive editor, director of the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. They've got an America First foreign policy they push over there. You might want to find out all about it, councilforthenationalinterest.org. And then, of course, also he writes for the American conservative magazine, UNS.com, and you can find some at Al Jazeera America as well. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us on the show again. Hey, listen, so lately I've been getting paranoid about, and we talked about this recently, too. In fact, there was the new State Department report came out. There was some analysis by Jonathan Landay and McClatchy and all that. And, you know, the administration, they're really wishy-washy on all this stuff because they're backing the terrorists in a lot of these instances. And so they're not being completely honest. But it seems like, you know, you've been saying on this show for years that, look, the real number of actual dangerous terrorists in the world is somewhere around a couple of thousand. So don't panic, right? But so now I'm wondering if maybe that number is quite a bit higher because of the Bush administration foreign policy in Iraq and the Obama administration foreign policy in Libya and especially in Syria. And, you know, Lande, who is, you know, no dough on this stuff, you know, I mean, I don't know if that's a phrase. I mean, like, doe-eyed, naive person or anything. He knows a lot about this stuff, too. And he was saying, hey, man, yeah, I mean, these guys have statelets, basically, on the ground in Syria where they are raising tax money and they are, you know, building little kind of mini states. And this is the most al-Qaeda anything ever. And I just wonder whether... You know, maybe right now we're in the equivalent of 1999 or 2000 or something, and maybe there's another shoe to drop here as the next phase of blowback from America's foreign policy kicks in. And I wonder whether, for example, we can trust the FBI, who are too busy entrapping retarded kids into saying they love Osama in a microphone or something, to stop the Boston attack or the Times Square attack or the Detroit airliner attack or anything else, whether we can depend on this government to protect us at all from the governments that they've created for us. And so now that was a lot of talk, and you go ahead.
Well, I think everything you said is true. And everything that he said was true too about the, you know, this becoming a more serious issue. But nevertheless, the bottom line in all this is that, you know, we're looking in at Syria kind of like it's everywhere. It's not everywhere. It's Syria. And we've created a situation in Syria that's become a breeding ground for a certain kind of itinerant terrorist who's been pretty much in existence ever since before 9/11 and has essentially gone from fight to fight to fight. These people are very dangerous. There's no question about them, about that. And if they also combine European nationality, which it did in the case of the most recent shooting in Brussels, well, then there's another security issue wrapped up into that, and we have to consider what is the security situation that has been created by largely unassimilated Muslims in Europe, and what does it mean? But the bottom line is still, are we Americans threatened by all this? I mean, is there a serious threat that requires us to be spending $1 trillion a year, that requires us to be using military forces in addition to intelligence resources and police resources? And my answer is no.
All right, now, what if you trusted them? What if, I don't know, all of a sudden, you know, the Bushes and Obamas and Clintons were gone and you had some competent adults, I don't know, your former best friend at CIA became the new guy in charge, somebody whose judgment you really rely on, and he said, listen, I don't want anything to do with world empire, we're not pivoting to Africa or to China or to dismember Russia or anything else, but we are going to hunt down and kill al-Qaeda guys from now on until they're gone. Would you support that, or even that is still just counterproductive?
No, I absolutely would support an intelligence and law enforcement effort against terrorists, but it has to be done with the full cooperation of the local governments in all these places where they have a terrorism problem. The whole idea that the United States can go in and fix things is a fiction because we don't know the situation on the ground. We don't know what the hell we're doing. And you basically have to work with these people. And even Obama last week at West Point, that's one of the smarter things he said. You know, you really have to, other people have to take the lead and we really have to work with them. Now, if you're limiting that to using intelligence resources, law enforcement, resources to deal with terrorism, I think that's the right approach.
What about drone wars?
Well, drone is a tool, but using drones to kill people, I'm opposed to in principle. I think that if you use a drone as an intelligence device and you're using it to locate people, to identify possible targets that you then go after using, again, intelligence and law enforcement resources on the ground, I think that's a perfectly legitimate use of drones, as long as they're not crashing into civilian airliners.
Yeah, which couple of close calls there so far. We're just
right.
Getting started on that. Anyway.
Exactly.
All right. Well, now, so, well, let's go back to the beginning of the Arab Spring here, because it seems like Assad, if the Americans had just stayed out of the Syria thing altogether, then Assad would have finished defeating the rebels a long time ago. And maybe that would have been bad for the decent people who were among those fighting them, but it seems like there's a lot of prisoner beheader and suicide bomber, Ayman al-Zawahiri loving crazies among them too, and it seems like my guess is that the war would have been over a long time ago. Not that the Americans have helped the jihadists to come anywhere near winning it, but they've just got 150,000 or so people killed.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happened. And the thing is that, you know, when you get into these what-if situations, it's not necessarily true that Assad might not have moved towards greater democratization if he didn't feel it was being done at gunpoint. So, I mean, you have to, you know, you have to kind of put yourselves in the heads of these other people. By all accounts, Bashir is not a crazy. And there are a number of options that he might have pursued if we had not pursued the military option by arming these people, by funding them and sending them in there.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, this is problematic, too, because Bush's approach to Syria was, you know, like we were talking about, outsource most of this to the local guys. That's part of what got us into this mess in the first place. And, you know, the stories of all the torture, Bush paying Assad to torture Al-Qaeda guys for the United States, ended up helping to recruit a lot of new Al-Qaeda guys into the fight in Iraq, for example, many of whom came across the border from Syria to fight there and now are back again. So it seems like we're sort of damned either way. You know, we outsource this whole thing to Mubarak. He ends up torturing Ayman al-Zawahiri and creating al-Qaeda in the first place.
Well, that's unfortunately the way it all works. I mean, the thing is, if you're constantly, you know, feeding the cancer, it's going to grow. And we've been doing that for a number of years. We've seen that invading Afghanistan just really pushed the terrorist situation into neighboring Pakistan. And from Pakistan, it's moved by our invasion of Iraq, creating a vacuum there, has moved into Iraq. And from Iraq, it's moved into Syria. And the whole point is that, you know, the United States has not quite ever figured out that military intervention doesn't fix anything. The only thing that can ultimately fix anything in a country is the people in the country themselves coming together for one reason or another and essentially deciding this is what we want, this is what we're going to do. And unfortunately, we've never seen these other countries as real partners. I mean, look at even this this situation over the weekend with Bowie Bergdahl being released. We didn't even tell the Afghan government that this was going on. I mean, how incredible is that? We've got 30,000 plus troops in the country. They've got an elected government that we kind of been propping up for so many years, and we don't even tell the guys that we're doing this.
All right. We got to stop and take this break. We'll be back with Phil Giraldi on America's Terror War right after this. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Phil Giraldi. He's at the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org, the American conservative magazine, UNZ.com, that's UNZ, UNZ.com, and America.aljazeera.com as well. And now, I guess we could pick this up where you were talking about how, after all this time, this government that America has installed in power and fought for all this time in the Afghan war, they don't even include them in on these highest level negotiations with the Taliban, their enemy, on the release of Bo Bergdahl here. And now apparently they're getting some of their very highest level leaders of the 1990s era back in exchange, or at least they're going to Qatar. I don't know if they'll be back in Afghanistan. I guess if I had to bet, I bet they'd be back in Afghanistan here before too long, now that they're out of Guantanamo. But so I guess I could ask you what you think the future of the war over there is going to be, because the whole point of the surge was to not really defeat the Taliban, but to hurt them bad enough that they would come to the table whimpering and make some kind of compromise. And yet that hasn't happened. And yet the war is ending anyway, more or less, I think, you know, going down to 10,000 troops. So I just wonder what you think about the relative strength of the Karzai regime plus the 10,000 U.S. Army troops and air power compared to the Taliban, and how you think the next couple of years are going to play out there.
Well, I think that there's no question that if, since the 10,000 troops are to a certain extent going to be combat troops, and there is going to be, as you point out, air support, that basically the regime in Kabul will be able to sustain itself. The real question becomes what happens after that U.S. support is completely gone in the following year, in 2016. I think that the obvious answer to that is that the regime had better start cutting a deal with the Taliban, because there's no military victory in sight. They're going to have to come to a political solution, which is probably what they should have tried to do 10 years ago. But anyway, you know, you can't point to a single example of a military intervention by the U.S., certainly since 9/11, anywhere, that's actually come out with a good result. And I think that that really is the argument to use against the neocons and everybody else who seem to think that the U.S. has to keep it asserting itself to validate itself as a world power. The fact is, the only thing that is invalidating the U.S. is the fact that so many things we've done have turned out badly.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I talked with Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, back last Friday. And one of the things that he's really concerned about is America validating itself to Al-Qaeda, and that if we leave after, quote, only 13 years, to them, that makes us the biggest joke in the whole wide world. We're supposedly the world's preeminent superpower, and yet they can chase us away with AK-47s and homemade landmines. And so why not finish us off or do whatever they want with us at this point if we're really, you know, that thin of a paper tiger? And I wonder whether... I mean, obviously, there's got to be some truth to the idea that they would have that impression, despite all of the brutality of the last decade. But, you know, is that going to be a problem, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think that's kind of inverting the problem or inverting the issue. The fact is that for a long time now, for 20 years, the U.S. has been kind of a recruiting poster child for Al-Qaeda and similar groups. Let's not forget Al-Qaeda is not unique, because of basically what the U.S. does around the world. So that's a given, and I think Michael is correct in saying that in a way the U.S. empowers Al-Qaeda. But the fact is, anybody who's following the situation in Afghanistan knows that the enemy is not Al-Qaeda, it's the Taliban. And the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are two distinct organizations. So if the question becomes the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is going to empower anybody, it will be the Taliban. I don't necessarily see the connection with Al-Qaeda.
Well, yeah, and again, it seems like if they'd wanted to make a deal a long time ago, they could have said, all right, you guys do whatever you want, except keep these guys out or else, again. That kind of thing would have been, they could have had that negotiation in the spring of 2002 or something, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think that this concept that Al-Qaeda and Taliban are identical has never been true. It was the Afghan government back in 2001 provided training camps for Al-Qaeda because they had similar objectives, or at least they thought they did. But the fact is that the Taliban, as you know, I'm sure, and maybe a lot of your listeners, back in at that time was willing to cut a deal with the United States to expel Al-Qaeda, but the U.S. was required to make a case to prove that they had been behind terrorist acts and this sort of thing, and either was unable or, I think in the case of, since it was George Bush at that time, unwilling to do so.
Right. Yeah, and that was something that Scheuer confirmed as well, that they were willing to turn him over on the slightest of evidence. You know, just hand me a piece of paper that says he did it on it or something. Give me an excuse to get rid of this guy, please. They were begging. But anyway, I guess that's not good enough. Not for a Bush.
Apparently not.
We surrender and run away is never good enough for a Bush, like Bill Hicks liked to say.
Yeah. Well, we may have another one coming. So the thought of the choice between a Bush and a Clinton is one of those existential moments when you want to, you know, move to the planet Zark.
Yeah, yeah.
The fifth galaxy,
or hell, just Mexico. Yeah. Just, you know, anything. Anyway, I learned Spanish. I don't give a damn. Immersion. That's how you learn it. You just get right in there, man. I love Mexican food as it is, as long as it's, you know, East Coast Mexico food. Anyway, Tex-Mex-ish, you know, the West Coast stuff is all got cilantro in it. Sucks. All right. Let's talk a little bit more about these jihadis in Syria. You're right. They're not all sworn to Ayman al-Zawahiri, just the leaders of the al-Nusra Front and the so-called Islamic Front now. ISIS is no longer sworn to Ayman al-Zawahiri, but all these guys are suicide bomber, prisoner beheader, bin Ladenites in ideology and in, you know, method, apparently. But so, you know what I really want to know from you, Phil, is if you could help explain to us just how much America has supported them directly or indirectly, kind of, you know, plausible deniability, having the Saudis and the Qataris do it, how much that has changed. Of course, we found out from Hirsch that they called off the rat line from Libya to Syria after the Benghazi attack of 2012. So there's been some hiccups and some different things. But they keep saying, oh, you know, Obama's just dragging his feet and doesn't want to back him. And yet it seems like he's been backing him all this time. And it's even at the Long War, or not Long War Journal, maybe it was Long War Journal, or I'm sorry, one of these pro-war, prominent pro-war blogs talked about how the TOW missiles are already in the hands of the al-Nusra Front. They got them from the Islamic Front. They got them from the whatever they're calling the FSA nowadays, something like that. So I just wonder how much responsibility can really be hung on the president and his foreign policy for, you know, Nusra, ISIS, the different groups there, and maybe over time, and however you like to explain it.
I think you have to give them responsibility for prolonging a severe humanitarian crisis. This, as you pointed out in the beginning, would have been over a long time ago, but for the fact that the United States has been supporting what they thought were the good rebels, or maybe they didn't even think that. It's not clear. But the fact is that, you know, weapons and money and logistical support is fungible. If you give it to somebody, you're not really sure who they are. It's almost inevitably, by Murphy's Law, going to wind up in the hands of the guys you didn't want to give it to. And then, of course, there were other players in the game, too. Qatar was a player. Saudi Arabia has been a player. And you know, it basically, and Hezbollah on the other side has been a player in Iran. There's like a devil's brew going on there. And I think you have to lay at the feet of the United States a lot of really bad policy, which has produced a really bad result. And admittedly, Obama would like to just probably walk away from it, but he knows that he can't, not anymore. It's he would get hung by his petard by the Republicans if he tried to do that in a lead during an election year. So we have the usual dilemma of American politics.
Well, it's amazing, too, the unreality of the discussion where, oh, man, damn clock. Well, here, I'm just going to keep recording you anyway. Here are these guys. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you tomorrow. So, Phil, the unreality of this discussion where the whole debate is between backing them some and or being complicit with the Saudis backing them and at least, you know, providing these fungible items, weapons and money especially. And the entire attack is that it's not enough support for them, even while everyone does recognize, and I'm talking TV pundits and you know, mainstream newspaper and website pundits and so forth, everybody recognizes that there have been Ladenites among the rebels there.
And yet, it's like these two truths don't ever show up in the same sentence anywhere except this show and the Moon of Alabama blog or something, right? It's always, yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of Bin Ladenites there. And also, yeah, Obama's not doing enough to back the rebels who are, never mind whether that's the very same Bin Ladenites we're talking about or not. In fact, the other day I saw Chuck Todd on the morning show on MSNBC say, wow, yeah, and Al-Qaeda's on the same side as us in this one. It's like, well, wait a minute, you're talking about how we're not in it yet, and we're just deciding to get in it. So how the hell are they on our side when we're the ones backing them in their war going on over there? What in the hell?
Yeah, well, it's the usual cognitive dissonance that takes place where they can't, you know, the government clear and these people in the media clearly can't accommodate two conflicting thoughts at the same time. And you're absolutely right. The basically, the whole premise is wrong. And yet they think that there is another issue that somehow sits in a box all by itself on the side that you don't have to think in terms of how it's interacting with your first issue. And it's incredible. I mean, these people are supposed to be smart, and some of them are. But, you know, people in government don't necessarily get ahead because they're smart. They get ahead because they work well with others,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. I studied this in junior college.
So, right, exactly.
It's the economics of what you say you're about, right? That's what it all
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh,
exactly.
Man. All right. Well, I'm a little bit less scared than I was after talking to Michael Scheuer about this. But I guess the ineptitude of, you know, I'm thinking, what, the Turks are going to hold all these guys back? That's really the question, right? How much of a threat this poses to Western Europe and or America? You know, what was great about Mohammed Atta and Ramzi bin al-Shib to Osama bin Laden was, you guys have German passports? Cool.
Yeah,
I wonder
right.
if you could
yeah,
get
exactly.
into America, you know?
Right. Right. Well, those are the only ones we really should be worrying about. People that actually can get over here, that are motivated, that have access, that have the brains to do this kind of, but you know, that's a handful of people. And to create a whole foreign policy around that kind of threat is just crazy. And that's why we've made the problem bigger, because we don't recognize that there's a big dysfunction there in terms of the way we look at everything.
Right. Absolutely. All right, very well said. Thank you very much for your time, Phil, as always. Appreciate it.
Okay, Scott. Take care. Bye-bye.
Everybody, that's Phil Giraldi. He's at the Council for the National Interest, councilforthenationalinterest.org. I hit the button a moment too soon there. I'm sorry. Councilforthenationalinterest.org, the American Conservative magazine at americanconservative.com or theamericanconservative.com. And UNZ, UNZ.com.